I have really, really good news. Billy Squier's got a new song.
Oh, Lord.
It's a banger.
Yes.
It's an absolute banger.
Like you want to bang your head on the floor?
What is wrong with you people?
This is Infrastructure Junkies.
Welcome, Infrastructure Junkies, to your show. This is a podcast created by right-of-way professionals for right-of-way professionals. The Infrastructure Junkies podcast is the voice of the right-of-way industry, exploring eminent domain, right-of-way acquisition, and infrastructure development. All right, buckle up, Infrastructure Junkies. It is Appraisers Roundtable number one. I'm Dave Arnold.
And I'm Kristen Short.
People still talk about an episode we did way back in season one called Is It Live? Is It Memorex? Where a group of us non-appraisers basically got together and started talking about appraisers and how crooked a bunch of them are. And it created quite a stir. So we followed it up with an episode called Revenge of the Appraisers with David Burgoyne, Brian O'Neill, and Christina Thorson. Revenge of the Appraisers still to this day is the number one downloaded episode of Infrastructure Junkies of all time. People quote these episodes back to us, and there is clearly a thirst for more appraisal discussion on the podcast. So we had this great idea. We decided that we were going to invite some appraisers back on to see if we could continue the discussion.
Yeah, and I would like to say that when you say we talked about how appraisers are crooks, I would like to exclude myself from that particular we. Thank you.
Oh, so you're just going to claim the good stuff and not so much the bad stuff?
I'm going to claim my stuff, which was the good stuff.
Well, I'll tell you this. I even heard through the grapevine that there were certain people that said, man, you said appraisers are bad, and what you said on that episode, your podcast is dead to me. Of course, they wouldn't say it to me. They'd say it to other people. But clearly, they're still listening now, aren't they?
They sure are. Hi.
Hello. So, Kristen, who do we have today?
I am so excited about this cast, our first guest, who is an appraiser, a wine connoisseur, a Dave Matthews hippie dancer, a hang glider, and a real estate mogul. You know her. You love her. Ladies and gentlemen, Christina Thorson is with us.
Hey, that's quite the introduction. Thank you, Kristen.
You're welcome. And joining Ms. Thorson is a fellow appraiser extraordinaire who established and manages the Cushman & Wakefield Infrastructure Appraisal Group. Hailing from North Carolina, not so much of a Dave Matthews hippie dancer, but still a fascinating guy and fellow infrastructure junkie, ladies and gentlemen, Anthony Flipping Alderman.
Oh, hey, everybody. Happy to be here.
And then, for special color commentary, we have the man who will deliver the news that you don't want to hear. He's a tree shaker, not a jelly maker, a man who puts on a clinic on how to be a cynic, eminent domain attorney extraordinaire, and Mr. Chicken Sacrificing Voodoo himself, Donald Rawson Schuyler Green.
Hi, Russ.
Way to put my whole name out there, Dave. Just my whole government name for everybody. Thank you.
So that's our crew. Let's get ready.
You cannot say that. You cannot say that, or they will take this podcast down faster than a project with no funding.
I just thought I'd see if you were paying attention.
I'm paying attention. You can't say that. So, everybody, welcome to Appraisers Roundtable number one. What does number one mean? Maybe there will be a number two if we're still speaking at the end of this episode. And I cannot guarantee that we'll still be speaking, because if nothing else, we're all going to speak our minds. And Ross and I are attorneys, and Christina and Anthony are appraisers. And sometimes we go together like oil and vinegar.
Oil and vinegar?
I don't know what the proper analogy is.
Well, sometimes maybe like salt and vinegar chips, which are a delight.
They are a delight. All right, Christina, you ready?
I'm ready.
Anthony?
Always.
All right. Here we go. First topic of discussion. We get a lot of questions about easements and valuation of easements. So let's start there. The various types of easements, like what could we be talking about in a right-of-way project? Anybody want to jump in and identify what you see most commonly?
The most common easement I'm seeing is the permanent utility easement, or a PUE. That is a very broad blanket type easement that they can put all kinds of utilities in.
Yeah, we see a lot of permanent easements, but we also see temporary easements for during construction and work. And those can take so many different forms.
What about drainage?
Sure.
We see a lot of those here. Yeah. Sound wall?
Sound wall easement. I'm not seeing very much of those.
Maintenance? Maybe it's a sound wall maintenance easement. What am I thinking of, Ross?
No, they call it either one of those things. But yeah, I mean, you got to have sound walls on your project to have the related maintenance easements.
Well, and yeah. I think probably in your neck of the woods, it's a lot more dense population. Where I hail from, down south, we have a lot more wind area, right? So we can make a wider space than having to have a wall.
Land area, is that some sort of disease that's borne by mosquitoes?
Yes.
Down in Tennessee?
Yes.
You can pick up some land area when you're hanging around the burn barrel?
That's right. You can get a shot for it.
Okay. And what other types of easements do we see in right-of-way cases?
Aerial utility easements.
Yeah.
You touched on drainage easements, the temporary construction easements. I've seen some dual utility easements where they have two specific utilities that they drop, that they are included in that easement language. It all comes back to easement language. So we're just naming the thing that the language is allowing the agency usually to do within that area that now they've acquired certain rights.
Well, let's talk a little bit about easement description, which I think really what I'm talking about, and Ross can correct me if I'm wrong, is like the drafting of an easement, like what rights are conferred within that easement. I've seen agencies try to keep that language as broad as they possibly can. And then what happened is the landowner attorney then turns it around and says, well, the way this easement is drafted, they could build a transformer all the way to the sky, like the Fountain Blue next to the Eden Rock, right?
Sure. I do think that language is super important. And as appraisers, we don't always have the ability to get that language ahead of time, but it's so crucial in valuation because if we don't know what's permitted in the easement, what rights the owner is losing or what could happen concurrently, we have no way to value it without understanding the gap between what the owner can do now and what the owner can do after the easement's imposed.
So what do? You're given an easement and let's say it's a PUE, a permanent utility easement, okay? And that's the one that I think, and again, Ross, chime in here. I think that is the one where it can really swing in either direction based on what they can do, underground, above ground maybe, or transformer box, or, you know, the Fountain Blue all the way to the sky. So do you request a copy of the easement to read the language?
Definitely. We definitely want the easement language.
It depends.
Okay, so you don't just see there's a PUE on this plat and you go along, do you actually read it? And is that a best practice?
Yes. So with easement valuation, there's two variations of the Jerry Maguire. That is, show me the language. Like, I can't value this remainder without knowing the easement language, or there's going to be a really big, extraordinary assumption that it will include all these items that are still available based on common easement language. And show me the market's reaction to this easement. Those are my two Jerry Maguire versions of show me the money, because without that, you're just living in this speculative world. Doesn't end well for anyone.
Don't you show the market reaction? Isn't that what you're supposed to do?
Yes, that's what I do. Okay. Yes, that's what I do. Yeah. When people come to me and they say, hey, this PUE allows me to build a wall 100 feet high along across the whole frontage, and maybe my access in 100 years is going to be gone. I'm like, that's all very interesting speculation about what's going to happen in this easement, maybe one day, right now in your imagination, but your conjecture is it could happen in the market. So I have to go out then and find properties with those same PUEs that have sold. And that then gives me market-based evidence to how the market reacts.
But the devil in the details, man. I mean, how do you go find a PUE in the market that's drafted identically to the one you're dealing with, unless it's the same company's language?
We recently have dealt with this in North Carolina specifically, where NCDOT's easement PUE language was being challenged. And luckily, our team has worked on so many thousands of parcels in North Carolina over a decade that we could go back and find properties that had the exact same PUE on them. They have transferred since, and then we get other transfers in that exact same area with no PUE. And the evidence we found then gives us a actual market transaction. It does get more challenging if the easement is unusual in some way, but that specific easement is quite common in the market.
Well, Christina, I think you said that, I want you to kind of answer the same question, but also I think that you said sometimes you don't have the easement language when you're assigned the task of appraising it. So what do you do?
100% what Anthony said. So either I can get the easement language, or in most of my experience, we make extraordinary assumptions, the use of which may affect assignment results. And you have to say that. USPAP requires that. Got to include that. But you make assumptions based on historical experience about how easements are used currently in the market, how they've been used historically with similar easement rights acquired. Of course, every state, every DOT agency has different language about what they call those easements. Construction and maintenance of slopes, or construction and maintenance of utilities. It just depends on the jurisdiction.
Do you ever go back to an agency and say, listen, the way this easement is drafted, you're looking at a much higher percentage than if you tighten up the language? Or do you just say, well, whatever, you know, that's what you gave me, that's what I'm going to appraise?
So that's a great question. I have frequently in the last dozen years, because I've been doing this a long time, but in the last dozen or 10 years, have said to the hiring or retaining person, hey, this easement's going to really cause problems and you're going to be paying for so much of the rights. Do you want to consider changing that? And they say to me, go ahead and complete the appraisal report. We've got to take your answer with the impact to the property back to the engineers, because engineers are driving that bus. But you're going to take that answer back to the engineers to say, hey, do we really need this level of easement? Because it's going to cost us $1 million. And the engineers look at the budget and they go, oh, maybe, no, we don't need that many rights. Maybe we can change that a little bit. Now appraise it again at the new scope of impact.
Damn engineers.
Does that happen often?
I wouldn't say often. I would say routinely. But hundreds of appraisals a year, and maybe half a dozen times a year, something like that. And sometimes it's not just the easement. Sometimes it could be we're taking their access. We're taking a right to access a road. We're taking one of the two driveways. Same kind of situation, but thinking about the impact of that easement, like taking all the parking on a piece of property for a temporary period. Yeah, that's going to affect the property a little bit.
Do you view easements in various gradations, meaning like some tend to be more onerous and therefore you compensate more highly? Is there a spectrum, or do you just take them as they come?
I think there's definitely a spectrum. Anthony?
Yeah, I would agree. Some easements are relatively innocuous. I mean, it's still a loss of a property right, but if it's just weekend hanging lines across the front of this very specific area of your property, what we can't do any subsurface or surface level improvements, and you can still use this area for a lot, then that's certainly going to be less impactful to both the easement area and the remainder.
Yeah, I presented at RWA conference several years ago with another appraiser in MA out of South Florida. And we talked about the gap. So an owner has certain rights to certain portions of their property. So if they're already in a setback area, so if the easement is occurring in an existing setback, then they have limited rights before the easement occurs. And so we're looking really at the gap between what can the owner do on the property now and what can they do after the imposition of the easement. What things are the agency going to be doing in that easement? And what rights does the owner lose? So what is that gap as a way to measure the impact to the value of that property?
Ross, any comments? You're awfully quiet over there. He's probably just stewing.
I know, right?
He's making me nervous.
No, I'm not.
Did you forget you were on a podcast today?
He agrees with everything we're saying. like 100.
That's exactly right.
I don't know about that.
Well, so far, he doesn't seem to have any complaints, and I haven't heard anything about Snake Charming anything. So,
no chicken sacrificing voodoo. Okay, so here's the next question. Let's talk about a temporary construction easement. And Ross, you may want to lead the discussion on this, whether property can really be permanently damaged from a temporary construction easement. Ross, have you seen that recently, or have you seen that claim?
I mean, people do attempt to make the claim. I mean, it's what are you doing with the apron for your entrance anyway, if you can go in and out of it, and there's a temporary construction easement over it, but you can still go in and out of it. What is really going on there? And the answer, I think, is essentially nothing. I mean, it's just like these claims where, do you spend a lot of time standing in the ditch in front of your property? People are like, oh, we put a strip take right here to put an easement across this area where you already don't do anything. What were you going to do? Stand in the ditch and wait to get hit by rocks from cars?
There he is. There he is, everyone.
Yeah, he's back. He's back. The man who will deliver the news you don't want to hear.
I mean, so wait, Ross, do you think temporary construction easements are just a bunch of bull?
No, I mean, they are a temporary easement. The real question is, can you have permanent damage, temporary easement? And I think the answer to that pretty much has to be no, because we're talking about permanent damage to the value of the property. And that's just not a thing you're going to get out of a temporary easement.
Okay, so here it is, appraisers. Pretend like we're on Facebook or something like that. A temporary construction easement cannot permanently damage a property. Prove me wrong.
I'd love to give you a scenario about temporary easements and parking. So if your temporary easement is a period of 3 to 5 years, and it's for the entire parking for a property, say an office or a restaurant or an apartment complex, if you're taking that parking right, so the owner cannot use the parking, the tenants can't use the parking for that period, and in the interim of that long period in a very active market, the highest and best use changes. Now they've got to pay to demolish the building to reactivate to get the new highest and best use. It feels more like a permanent damage or an impact to the overall value of that property.
I guess what you're saying is if an agency puts a TCE on substantially all or all of the parking lot of an ongoing business, the business can't really function.
No, not at all.
And so during the duration of that easement, there's no question the value of that property changes, because you wouldn't get the same for a property with a TCE over its parking as opposed to one with 50 parking spaces.
Correct.
But do we really see that often? Come on. Who would do that?
I have several right now.
Yeah, it happens.
So, no. And this is just piling assumptions on assumptions anyway. You can't rent additional parking and cause a cost to cure and thus not have a permanent damage. We'll just ignore that can happen.
Well, so a cost to cure is only another way to measure damages. That is to say, if we can cure it for less than the cost of the damage or impact the value of the property, sure. However, if there is no alternative parking within walking distance, there's no way to cure that.
Yeah, you still haven't damaged the realty. You're talking about a business loss.
I don't think so. Not if you are a tenant-occupied property. So say you're an office building with multiple tenants. You're taking all of the parking for that temporary period. And in the interim, because maybe currently that highest and best use is close to flipping because of a change in use, where in the market, that owner might pay money 5 years from now. They'll have the income during that period and pay money 5 years from now to tear the building down and redevelop the property. But in this case, they're being artificially forced to make that decision earlier because they're not getting the revenue.
So one reaction I've seen to what Christina's describing is some creative appraisers would then try to value that TCE based on the lost rent, which kind of goes back to what Christina was saying before. When we see a project and we see issues, I immediately call my client up like, hey, bro, this is going to be a problem.
Do you literally say bro? Do you?
Please say bro to your clients.
What if it's a woman?
My guy.
I've heard him.
Chat. when this is going to be a problem. And they're like, yeah, the engineers don't want to hear it. So do the report, and the report will drive them to consider making some changes. I had an appraiser early on, and it was just, I don't remember what the situation was, but something that the agency was doing was causing some outlandish damage. And he got on Facebook and started ranting, and I called him up. I was like, listen, man, they're not going to do that thing. They're not going to take three parking spaces and damage out an entire CVS. Like, they're going to change the plans. They just had to see your number first. Like, calm down. And he was like, oh, okay, sorry.
So really, we should be doing an episode about the villainous engineers.
We don't need to make any more enemies, Dave.
Well, I mean, I do agree about the villainous engineers. They're just like, oh, well, it has to be a straight line. We don't care what's in the way of the line. Why would it be anything but a straight line?
Okay, I can't wait for conference. Every engineer who attends is going to be like, you guys suck. Your podcast is dead to me.
Engineers are like the osteopaths of the like professional world. Like, have you ever seen other doctors that actually care? And then osteopaths are just like, no. Not osteopaths. I'm saying the wrong word. Oh, Lord.
Maybe you ought to fix it.
No, we're all going to be looking at osteopath. I have no idea what that is.
That's like a voodoo doctor, right?
No, I'm sorry.
It's not an MD. It's a DO.
A DO. A doctor. Yeah, a DO. A DO. So an engineer is like the DO of the infrastructure world? I don't think so. I think they're like the neurologist or the brain surgeon.
Now the appraisers, the engineers, and the osteopaths are all going to be mad at Ross.
That's okay. That's all right. This episode of Infrastructure Junkies is generously sponsored by Blackbird Right-of-Way. If you are looking for compliant, timely, and innovative relocation solutions, this is exactly what Blackbird does. Kristen Short and her team deliver every parcel, every time. Find them at blackbirdrow.com, blackbirdrow.com. Enough about easements, okay? That was fascinating, by the way, and I really enjoyed it. So the next topic we're going to discuss was submitted by my friend Ross, and it is why the cost approach is garbage.
Oh, boy.
Lord help.
And I will say, I tend to agree with Ross. It is so easily manipulated and has been abused during the course of litigation more than any other approach that I've seen.
I don't disagree.
Prove me wrong.
I don't disagree. So if you have an unethical appraiser, they can do that to any approach, quite frankly. I think the cost approach is a very helpful tool. Sorry, Ross. Disagreeing 100%. Because it does look at what would be the cost to buy a piece of land, build a similar, functionally similar property to the thing you're appraising, and then using market information to estimate depreciation. I think that gives you a bright guideline when you compare it to the sales comparison or the income approach to see if there's a gap in the market. Like, is there a gap that people would be out developing new ones of the subject property type? Or is the cost so high that right now it's pushing the sales comparison approach up because people are not going to go out and buy a piece of land and build a similar property because it's too expensive? We had that in 21, I think. Wouldn't you agree, Anthony, with the cost of construction materials? Good grief. Yeah. And labor?
Ross, what do you think about that?
I think the part that they skip is the, like, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain about market data about depreciation, which basically doesn't exist. And when you explore it, you find out that they just made it up. And then they probably pawned it off on the engineer who's going to say, I didn't talk to them, or I don't know what you're talking about.
So let me stop you right there, Ross, because that's wrong. You might be dealing with appraisers who don't know what they're doing and don't know how to estimate market depreciation, but it is in fact a thing and you can't actually do it. Basically, if you do a cost approach for each of your comparables, you can determine market depreciation from that sale. I've done it hundreds of times.
So you took some made up garbage and then stacked some more things on top of it and said that it's valid.
I didn't make up the sales price.
Because you started with an income approach, which you manipulate anyway via the cap rate. So then you made up that number and then made another made up number on top of that.
No, I'm not comparing it usually to the income approach. I'm usually comparing it to sales comparison. So I'm doing a cost approach new on my sales comps to see, you take the sales comp, you deduct out the land, you estimate the cost new for the improvements that are on that comp, and then you compare the cost new to the contribution of the improvements on that comp.
Yeah.
Simple yep. process. People were afraid of it. Appraisers don't understand it, yep. don't know how to do it. But I think it's a fabulous yep. tool. And it really does say what the market thinks about appreciation.
Extracting depreciation from market sales transaction is really the way to go for getting a solid depreciation number. It is a challenging approach. And I think that's why appraisal theory, the more approaches, the better. It's an indication of value, not the indication of value. And so it's why you want the three approaches. Because if one starts to get out of whack, what's going on there? Or do I have the wrong comps? Have I misunderstood? So it's always a really nice feeling when the three approaches of value come in like tight. It doesn't happen that often, but they are informing one another. So you have to assess what the market cares about.
Right. So you're talking about an approach that you're saying you do, or Christina, and then Anthony's like, it's very hard. And then essentially other people don't do. So it's not as if, well, apparently Christina knows how to do this thing, which requires market data that I gather most people aren't going to get. Because the real key item here that's intriguing to me is we're not usually valuing houses. So you have to have data. And most of the time, my problem with appraisers is they claim there is no data. And usually that seems to be a function of ignoring the principle of expanding the geographic scope and not willing to go search out the data. They're just like, oh, there are no comps. Therefore, we'll just make this up. And then, okay, we'll just use the cost approach only because we couldn't find any comps or data. And then we didn't extract any data to make the cost approach. So it is whatever we say it is. I mean, it's theoretically possible to perform appraisals in a way that they're reputable. But since USPAP doesn't require you to actually make it be credible to anybody except the client, there's really no guarantee in there for appraisers that you're actually providing a data reliable to anybody else. It's like, well, it was satisfactory to the client, so good enough. Rest of you market participants just deal with whatever we made up to satisfy our client.
Oh, boy.
All right. Who did not silence their phone? Who didn't silence their phone?
Sorry, that's my computer. I've got my phone silenced.
Oh, okay.
People want me, Dave.
You are a popular appraiser.
They just want to reach out and find me and give me work.
Everybody wants a piece of Christina.
It's fine. I've already made an idiot of myself twice here. I meant orthopod. I might have to
Orthopod, is that a type of insect?
What?
No, I said osteopath instead of orthopod.
Okay.
What's an orthopod?
Nobody knows, Kristen. That's some Ross made up stuff.
What?
Do you want to explain?
Yes, please.
Just ignore that I said osteopath. We need, like, it doesn't bear on the joke.
So
an orthopod is a bone doctor.
A bone doctor.
And all they care about is fixing the bone. They don't care if the human dies. They're just like, there's a bone. I must fix it.
Now we don't have any orthopod friends.
That was an orthopedist.
Yeah, I think it's an orthopedist.
Isn't it orthopedist?
Yeah, pretty sure.
All right. One more thing before we leave these different approaches to value is we talked about the cost approach. And listen, Ross puts on a clinic on how to be a cynic, but there's a good reason for that because we see this stuff manipulated all the time.
Yeah,
sure.
And one thing I just want to give everybody the chance to comment on before we move on is this thing called the cap rate in the income approach, which as far as I can tell is just a made up number and you make it higher or lower depending on who you're trying to please. That's my observation from the cheap seats. And sometimes my seat's not all that cheap.
Yeah. So by the time appraisals get to you, Dave and Ross, there has been a weeding out process of what each side needs for whom they are advocating. Cost approach, the income approach are far less controversial in other spaces that appraisals are done. But to your point, a cap rate is a number that represents the relationship between income the property is generating and its purchase price. So it isn't made up, but because it represents, it is an actual relationship out there that is very easy to go out and ascertain for most property types. So if appraisers don't have extracted cap rates or overall rates from the market to support the rate that they're selecting for the appraisal that you're looking at, then to Ross's point, they're not doing their job. They're simply picking a number that oftentimes works in the favor of the client they're working for. Now the appraiser's going to be mad at me because I just said that.
Ross? Well, he said I was right.
Podcast up.
Podcast over.
Anthony has a really good point that there is enough data. And I think Ross said the same thing. If you widen the geography, and in my mind, also, if you widen the time, as long as it's similar economic conditions, and with the dependency that in a small area, like a small county in South Georgia that has 10,000 parcels, if you have 1,000 real sales a year, that's probably okay. Maybe there's no sales of the thing you're appraising, like a fast food. But if you go to adjacent counties, there may be. And some of those adjacent counties are going to have properties that are leased. And so if you can get the actual income and you have an actual sales price, the cap rate is just literally math. So that's just one market indication. One sale does not a market make. One cap rate does not a market make. And I think the failure a lot of times of appraisers is, like Ross said, not looking further. I know it's controversial, but I'm going to agree with Ross on this.
What is happening right now?
I know. He's not wrong. Expanding your universe of consideration for data. Maybe you're not using that sales comparable as a direct comparable for the value of the property, but you're looking at that relationship Anthony was talking about, that the investor is considering, what is the value or the price I will pay for that property based on its current income? That's the capitalization rate. That's that metric.
Okay. A cap rate is related to math, kind of like a good bedtime story is related to math.
Well,
they're both made up.
No.
They're both made up.
Dave, it's literally math.
I know, but I've seen it abused so bad. Like, why is this cap rate where it is? This makes like, because in my estimation as an appraiser who's been doing this a long time for landowners, that's where it needs to be. No, that's where you want to put a $10 million damage on a piece of property because the landowner's attorney told you to.
I think those people are doing it wrong. I have to agree. And I don't care who hires me. I work for both sides. Really, I think it's crucial to be as fair as possible to the property owner and to all of us as taxpayers who are paying for that infrastructure and that acquisition.
Yep. Hallelujah. Preach.
Hallelujah.
Preach it, sister.
Whoa.
I'm about to start singing Kumbaya up in here.
Well, this is going to be very boring if everybody keeps agreeing.
I won't keep agreeing.
We're supposed to be unbiased, and the value is going to be the same. So
right.
I'm pretty upfront when property owner representatives call me, like, you're going to get my value. And really, if you're looking for some pumped up number, if you have this idea that they took a foot of my property and now the remainder is automatically damaged, I'm not your guy. It's okay. There are other people that you can talk to. It's just not me.
Yeah. The industry problem is that there is a guy for that.
Good point.
That is, but let me tell you, there's a bigger industry problem. I think maybe Dave and Kristen were in the back of the room when I presented in Scottsdale, Arizona.
We were there.
Yep, we were.
ALICLE 2022.
Sounds right. And one of the attorneys I was presenting with said, oh yeah, if I call, make it up, Anthony, or if I call Christina, and they're not willing to give me the number I like, I'll just keep calling so some appraiser will agree. And that's the attorney driving that bus.
Set it in the room.
Set it in the room.
Set it in the room.
And weren't y'all proud of me? I did not punch him. I wanted to. Oh, my face got red. I wanted to just punch him in the nose. But I calmly took a deep breath and said, we've just figured out the difference between an attorney who is an advocate and an appraiser who is unbiased and has no dog in that fight.
You mean you?
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I love how you're like an appraiser. I'm like, no, because this entire thing just proved that's not how that works. You just shop until you find the guy that will say the number that you want.
Shop until you find the guy.
Shop till you found the guy.
And if I recall what was actually said in that, names were named and they...
Wow.
Yes, names were named. Well, at least the state was identified where they got the appraiser from.
Yes. Wow.
So when you do agency work, mostly like my team, and every court case, the agency is the bad guy, the big bad guy. And so as a part of our due diligence being good appraisers, but also recognizing the fact that we have to go above and beyond, like we have to cross every T, dot every I, dig into every possibility of ways to make our report credible to a jury. That's what we got to do.
You know, I'm going to interrupt this scintillating conversation. I have really, really good news.
Did you save money on your car insurance?
We're going to lunch somewhere good after this.
Not even that, but I don't know whether you know, but you know, Billy Squier's got a fairly new song.
Oh, Lord.
I had heard.
Oh, boy.
It's a banger.
Yes.
It's an absolute banger.
Like you want to bang your head on the floor?
What is wrong with you people?
Yes.
No, it's called Harder on a Woman.
I'm just saying.
It's called Skibbity Ohio Riz.
I'd be more likely to listen to Skibbity Ohio Riz. That sounds like a banger.
What is wrong? It's a brand new Billy Squier song for the first time in years and years. And I think it might have actually come out last year, but in the general context of things, it's hot off the presses.
Is it though?
That assumes anything from Billy Squier could be hot off the press. I mean, what was this?
Anthony, like, where's my support here, brother? Come on.
Hey, Billy slays. I mean, he wails. He's, yeah.
I'll read you some lyrics. I mean, this one, the only person who's ever in the history of rock and roll written better lyrics than this is David Lee Roth.
What?
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. What is happening?
One of his lines is, I try to love you, baby, best as I can. I mean, Jesus, guys, nobody's writing stuff like that anymore. It's real rock and roll.
What an artist.
There's a reason nobody's writing stuff like that.
Well, there are a lot more relevant lyrics in that song than that one.
But that's the best one. That just delivers it. Delivers the mail. Delivers the news no one wants to hear, Ross.
He's putting out his weakness.
He's vulnerable.
Wait, did y'all listen to this song? Because that's not what it's about.
The openness to Billy here that
I don't. It's
let's talk about the line. Let's talk about the line.
I'm not even getting into what this is about. I don't have a uterus.
Okay. I will tell you this, and we're going to wrap up Billy Squier. This song is such a sweaty, try hard attempt at being politically correct that it actually becomes politically incorrect with some of its lyrics. Some of its lyrics are actually offensive. He's trying so hard to be politically correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
I was so confused by the song, yes.
Right. It's confusing, but let me tell you something. I'll just give our listeners a little insight. Dave asked all of us to listen to this song before this podcast, and I'm wondering, like, did Billy Squier wake up this morning and be like, oh my God, I got 5 listens?
I bet he did.
He probably made like 32 cents from us streaming it.
If he got any.
You guys, I'm starting a new podcast. You know, Schumacher gave up his. I'm going to see if I can take over that one. Something that's reputable. Rapscallions.
Spell the name of it wrong like this guy spells his last name.
Right?
Billy Squier does not spell his last name wrong, Ross. You spell your last name wrong. You put an E on green.
S-Q-U-I-E-R.
Yeah.
That doesn't spell Squier. It spells like skewer.
Squier. Billy right. Squier.
So,
and I thought when I first started to read it, I really thought it was going to say Billy Strings, and I was super excited. And then I realized it said Billy Squiers, and I was like,
that would have been much better. That would have been much better.
Now, I've never seen Billy Squiers, but I have seen Billy Strings.
It took me a minute to parse that he's taking a dig at Clarence Thomas.
Ah, is that what he's doing?
That's what it's about, at least in the apparently politically incorrect first paragraph of the lyrics.
Yeah, that's the part that went too far, I thought. I thought he was talking about a bailiff at the courthouse.
That was my initial reaction, and then after I left it on repeat driving over here, to give it a fair trial, because the first time out, I was like, God, this is hot garbage. He's just ripped off riffs and flourishes from other tracks, sort of Frankensteined them together. and then put like an attempt at a current zeitgeist set of lyrics on here to try to make himself relevant. But I let it play for the whole trip over here. And I was like, once you let this kind of earworm for a while, it's not bad. It's like classic rock elevator music. If I were a better musician, I would be able to parse out for you exactly which parts he ripped off from where. But I swear.
He ripped it off from himself. He's a classic rock artist. All right. One more topic before we wrap up. And this is another humdinger for me. It's another thing that I have seen abused over the last 10 or 15 years in eminent domain cases. When is special purpose really so special?
Here we go.
Is there really such thing as a special purpose property? I know the texts say that there are. But then, you know, Ross and I had a series of cases on a major highway project that impacted a lot of commercial properties. And hot dang, every single commercial property on that sucker was special purpose so that they could use the cost approach
only
and manipulate the whole thing.
Oh, boy.
So we had a funeral home, which they said was special purpose because it could only be used as a funeral home. But turns out that funeral home had been converted from a steakhouse.
Yeah, it
was. And you can't make this up, by the way.
It was a Texas Roadhouse.
It had been a steakhouse that was converted to a funeral home.
But now it was unique because they had put up the general type pressed steel, you know, chapel on one end of it. Therefore, it was unique. And they had a broker testify it was the finest property in Virginia Beach, if I recall. And then they were like, essentially that it was special purpose and irreplaceable. And their response to losing it was to just take the money, go one block down, buy an office building, and then stick a chapel of the same type to the side of the office building. So they just moved this. They were like, they're basically like a hermit crab. They're like, here, we'll just forget everything we said about valuing this building. Move one block down, buy a completely different building type, empty it, strap a chapel onto it, and call it a funeral home and go.
So, Anthony Alderman, give me an example, a real example of a special purpose property.
The most common special purpose property is a traditional church with the steeple and all that. Like, you run across that pretty regularly.
You can turn it into a restaurant.
It can be a house.
It can. Any property has adaptable reuses.
There's also a market out there for churches, so you can use the comparable sales approach. See, this special purpose needs to be removed from the appraisal of real estate.
Right.
It's just something that they can be manipulating. Prove me wrong.
I think it's a catch-all term in my practice for it doesn't fall into the big category of commercial, industrial, office. Right. If it doesn't fall into those main categories that most of the real estate we're dealing with, it just gets slotted into special purpose.
So what about like a Top Golf, something like that? I mean,
that's pretty purpose driven. I mean, its construction would be odd for an alternative use.
Okay. Yeah. But if it's prime real estate, couldn't you put multifamily housing on it? Like, isn't that really its highest and best use and not as a Top Golf? Or is it?
It depends.
Oh.
Where's the gap?
Typical.
What's the occupancy of multifamily?
They're mostly a restaurant and bar anyway. You know, just turn those golf things into outdoor drinking spaces. I don't know. Like,
that would be great, actually. Just forget the golf entirely and put a different bar, like turn it into like a par three, put a different bar on each hole. And then like you just basically go to the different holes and drink at them to play around.
I like it.
It's
inside one building.
Yes.
I love it.
Top Golf crawl, but there's no golf.
I've come up with a genius idea. Watch it come into being because I have put the energy in the universe.
You've done
Kristen,
it.
Kristen, did you say par hop?
Tony. Tony the goat. Tony the goat with the pun.
The goat.
Well, guys, has this been fun?
Absolutely.
Do you think that we're still good enough friends that we might do this again sometime?
Buy me dinner, Dave. No, of course.
I think you bought me dinner last time, so I probably owe you about 14 dinners based on New Orleans.
For sure.
Oh, I see the jig. Last time I was with Dave, I bought dinner.
Uh-oh. Yeah, Dave, it pays to have a podcast. Podcasting is really lucrative in offbeat ways.
Sure.
You're going to retire from the practice of law for this, right?
That's right. Anthony Alderman, Christina Thorson, our appraiser extraordinaires, thank you. Thank you, Ross, for your colorful commentary. Thank you so much for joining us.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.